This is John McEwen on syndicatednews.net, the Americana Music Show. And I've got the pleasure of talking to somebody that, well, there was a time when he was hard to get in to see. This is Mr. Barry Fay on the phone.
Oh, it was never hard for you, John.
Well, that's because I knew Chuck.
Chuck who?
Yeah, that's what a lot of people say. He's referring to Chuck Morris, who's running concerts in Denver, which is what Barry Fay used to do. Barry, there's a lot of people that know you, but a lot of them are on the inside of the box office or on the stage side of concert performing. What would you say to somebody that just said, oh, what did you do? Who is Barry Fay and what has he done in your network?
Well, I would say this, that not Barry Fay in particular or in general, you could say, the promoters are the infantry of our business. I mean, they're the ones who do the attacking. Guys like John McEwen who are in a group, they get a guarantee, and they're happy, and they have agents and managers and sound and light companies and everything else. Everybody gets a guarantee except the poor promoter.
But in you being the poor promoter, that may be how you started with Baby Huey, but it went on to become Barry Fay, one of the most known promoters in the country, for those that are listening. And that don't know him. He brought Led Zeppelin to North America for the first time in 1960. Well, wait a minute. What year 68. Was it? 68.
December 26, 1968.
I was afraid to say it. Did anybody know, other than you, who Led Zeppelin was?
No. In fact, I didn't know who they were because they sold them to me on the show was sold out. It was with Vanilla Fudge and Spirit. And we were sold out. And they called me and they said, we want to add another group. And I said, wait a minute. You don't understand. There's no tickets, no advertising. I'm not adding anybody. And then they said, oh, please, it's going to be a huge group, Led Zeppelin. And I thought they were joking, like a lead balloon. And they said, well, it's only, you know, $1,500. I said, you don't understand. That's no money because there's no reason. There's no advertising. But they called me back, and they said that Vanilla Fudge, the headliner, was willing to pay $750 out of their money if I would pay the other $750. So I started to think. I said, you know, come on. They're willing to do that. Maybe it is something special. So we add them to the show, and there's no spots, John. There's no radio, no nothing.
Right.
And so when they come, it's the day after Christmas, and I go up and announce them. I say, ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome for Led Zeppelin. No one knew who they were. Uh-huh. No one had any idea. But the minute they stepped on stage and Roberts let loose that voice, man, you could tell. Oh, my God, it was amazing.
You could tell.
Oh, everybody could tell. Because
how soon after that did you try booking more Led Zeppelin shows?
Oh, I guess it had to be at least a minute and a half. But you remember Max Floyd, don't you, from KLZ-FM?
Yes, I do.
He called me and said, who was that you had last night? People are just storming the station. They want us to have, we don't have any music, so I brought him over the white copy of the album they gave me, and they played it all day. It was just a significant event.
Well, that's an indication.
Almost like a dirt band date.
Yeah, funny guy. That's an indication for those that are listening that don't know Barry Fay. But Barry, really, maybe you're being too humble. How would you describe?
Wait, what did you say?
Yeah, it was a shock to me too that I even used that word with you in a sentence. How would you describe your contribution or what you were doing in the 70s and 80s and?
Well, it started really in the 60s and 67, and I'm not being modest or humble, but I was in the right place at the right time. That's all. It happened time and time again that I just was in the right place at the right time.
As it was,
and I took advantage of it. I loved the people. I took advantage. I always took care of the audience, and I had fairly good ears. I liked certain groups. I mean, I made good relationships with groups that got big, and not like today. The groups got big and took me with them. That's all.
Groups like who?
Well, all the way from 69 with the Stones to 1981 with the U2.
And in between?
Everybody, John.
Well, see, our audience doesn't know who the everybody is. I do know your background. I was there.
Well, I'm saying everybody that mattered. I mean, if you didn't matter, you didn't play for us. Gosh. The only here, make it easy on yourself, because I always try to make it easy on you, John. The only group I didn't play was the Beatles, because they were not together when I started in 67. But anybody else, you name a group, I played them.
I understand.
We had kind of a monopoly, which is not a good thing, but...
Did you do the early U2 shows?
Of course.
And
at the Rainbow Music Hall in 1981. Yeah.
For those that don't know, which are many hopefully listening and learning about Barry Fay, the reason I'm talking to him here, he has a book out that talks about this incredible past and this legacy that he's left for, along with Bill Graham and John Scheer and some other promoters in the country, helped set the tone of what people do when they go to a rock concert. And that tone, by that I mean how you're treated when you go in, what goes on, the production, the lights. Barry's one of those few people that put up the money, incredible amounts of money, sometimes a $1 million guarantee before the tickets went on sale. What was the highest money you laid out before a show was actually ready to go on sale? I mean, that you're committing to.
Committing to or laying out, you only had to put out 50%.
Right.
But I would say $250,000 because when the acts, John, got to a certain point, I mean, the Stones, they didn't worry about it. They knew they were going to sell every ticket, and they were getting a percentage. But even today, I think, I'm not sure, as of a few years ago, Metallica would only get a $25,000 guarantee. But the US Festival, which I booked, I did not put up the money. I mean, the loss on that thing was like $10 to $12 million.
Because?
Because it was impossible for, not enough people could come, but the promoter didn't care. He owned, Apple. Steve Wozniak, that's a funny thing, we were talking about it yesterday. I said, Steve, you lost $12 million. He said, well, I better stop. I only got about 45 more of these into me, The promoter was the front line, but you had to take care of your audience. I think if there's anything that I really cared about, that was it. And it's funny you mentioned past, because the book's title is Backstage Past.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's at. I mean, I did everybody, and I mean I can say everybody, but, you have tremendous memories. I mean, Jimi Hendrix, Janis, Jim Morrison, they died too soon. And I was the first one to do Led Zeppelin. And my first show was The Doors, Jim Morrison.
What year was that?
That was 1967, September 29th.
Now, when you say first show and all these promotions you're talking about, principally in the Denver market, but you spread out other places too.
Yeah, my first show outside of Denver was actually New Year's Eve, 67, with Canned Heat in Phoenix. And then 2 years later, I went to Salt Lake, and I was doing Phoenix and Salt Lake, and then Kansas City, St. Louis, and then Dallas and Houston. I had a pretty good piece of the country, which was very nice.
So for people to get a better feel about the risk, it's always an intriguing part. Because, being on the band side with Nitty Gritty Dirt Band for 45 years, which I'm proud of, I get these questions all the time. And, how does somebody put on a concert? And what does a promoter do? And who is an agent? And, a lot of people listening know nothing other than they go somewhere to buy a ticket and they go to a show.
And let's face it, that's all they should know. I mean, it's not their problem. All the other problems aren't their problem, but
it's a problem. I'm just trying to say that what goes on behind the scenes is intriguing to a lot of people. For instance, how many shows did you do in the middle 70s? How many were you doing? Just a guess, within, say, 77, 78, that time period.
I did about 350, 375 a year.
Now, I'll let that sink in for people to think that Barry Fay was responsible for 350 concerts in a year as a normal manner of doing business. That means that 350 halls, concert halls or arenas or small rooms like 1,500 seats, all had to have money guaranteed to them. The groups had to have money guaranteed. And I would guess, if you're going with that 250 figure, that you must have had easily $20 million in deposits on the line any given time period.
No, I couldn't have that much. I never had that much. But,
come on, Barry. You were the promoter.
No,
you made all the,
it wasn't
you made
that
all the
much
money.
Because, like in 72, when I did 17 Stones dates, I didn't put up that much because, we all knew each other. We weren't going anywhere, and the seats sold out in one day. mm-hmm. and would pay him with ticket money. I mean, that's still done today, but it wasn't the money. It was a tremendous risk. Anything can happen. I mean, you can have 17 Stones dates like I did in Keith Hertz's wrist. Then what happens?
Yeah.
And you're out all the advertising and the hall deposits, but that's the risk you take, you know. It wasn't always a great business. It was a pretty good business. Can I tell you a story you never knew?
I would be glad to hear it.
When I was doing all those dirt band dates and you were playing with Brewer and Shipley,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was pretty straight when I first got in the business. And you know their big hit, what was it?
One Toke Over the Line.
I thought it was One Toe Over the Line. I didn't know what a toke was.
Well,
but I mean, for the insides, the book is a good book. I think it's something. It's not a book that you can just read and put down because you want to go back to it. There's some pretty interesting things in there about how the business really runs. But whatever happened back then, John, I'll tell you, it's better than what's going on now.
And why do you say that?
Well, when I retired in 1997, the highest I had ever charged for a ticket was $71. And that was all in the same year, 94, when the Stones came back and Pink Floyd came back and the Eagles played on their Hell Freezes Over tour.
Mm-hmm.
Now you got $300-$400 tickets. It's mad. It's insane.
That's
my opinion, but it is. No one's worth that.
This is funny. Well, why did you do it? Well, just simply, why did you do it? Was it the rush of getting the people in the room and whatever the size of the room was? Was it the music? Was it? Did you like all the music that you presented?
No.
No,
I didn't have to like it. I was not a dictator. I was not an educator. I didn't tell people what they should like. I was a messenger. I went and found out what they did like and got it.
But it was
a combination. First of all, when we started, we had no idea. I'm sure you know this. How long it was going to last.
Mm-hmm.
So we went from one show to another, and then we had, in 69, the Denver Pop Festival, which really put Denver on the map.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we didn't even know what a pop festival was, but we did one. And, you know, and we just grew. We grew very big, but still, you can't forget who the people are paying to see. It's not me. It's the acts. And there were so many great acts. I mean, in the old days, we had great acts and very few places to put them. Now you got a lot of places, and the acts suck. But, oh, can you say that on radio? Yeah, I guess you can
say whatever. You're Barry Fay.
Ooh, what you almost said. I mean,
I
used to have, like, you know, great, great musicians dabbling in drugs. Now you got drug addicts dabbling in music. It's not the same. But, I mean, I know you can't. Maybe you can say that. I can't because I'll never be on your show again, and I don't really care. But, the business is gone. There's no heart. There's no soul. There's no loyalty. It's all money.
Well, Barry, you said the heart of the business is gone. How do you? What do you mean?
I think the heart and the soul of it is gone. It's it went from the music business to the business of music, where the act used to have to tour to support their album. Now they tour to support themselves. That's why you have such astronomical ticket prices. I don't see how people afford to go to shows. But
I don't either. And there's fewer shows sometimes, and it's just what I see about the heart being missing is you're humbly saying earlier you booked people that you thought that people were liking. But in the case of Zeppelin, you said in about a minute and a half after I heard them, I wanted to book other dates. You also had a tendency, an ability to see what was coming.
Well, yeah, you had to be lucky. You had to be right. I mean, you could. There's a lot of groups that are like the 13th floor elevator that no one ended up hearing about. But if you were right and the music was good and the people liked them, that's all that it took. I mean, let's face it, they played the Rainbow Music Hall twice and then took off to McNichols Arena, which was 18,000 seats, then the US Festival in front of hundreds of thousands.
Now, the U2 playing the Rainbow Music Hall, Barry's referring to a now-closed venue in Denver that held 1,450 people, I believe, somewhere 15.
That's correct.
And he also owned that, and he would bring people in there to kind of test the market or give them exposure and build them so they could play Red Rocks.
Right. I mean, it was just a process where the groups would get, you know, bigger as people would see them. I mean, I saw two songs from U2 and went right and called Frank Barcelona, who, you know, their agent, and said, this is going to be the biggest group in the world. I said, they had the music integrity of the early Who. I mean, and that's, you know, it turned out they were now the biggest group in the world.
Yeah.
It's nice to be right once in a while.
You were right more than once in a while.
How but, come you weren't this complimentary when we knew each other? I think it was your brother.
You didn't give me a chance, Barry.
Oh, okay.
And along those lines, in all the accomplishments you did to become known as one of the top promoters in the history of rock and roll promoting, and that's why your website is called has the title The Rock Father, which I think is well earned, because you kept at it. And you knew Bill Graham. Did you know him early on?
No, I didn't meet Bill until 73.
And what happened after that meeting? Did you partner up? Did you like him? Did you get along?
Well, we did the Stones in Hawaii together. That was the first time we partnered up. But I'd rather you... No, it sounds so rotten to say read the book, but there's a lot about Bill in there.
Really?
I was going to say pro and con, but mostly, I guess when it turns out, mostly con. But you got to understand, this is from my standpoint. That's what this book is, John. It's my view of our business, the rock and roll business, and how I grew up with it and what I thought about it. And it's a very frank book, but it's all one thing. I'll promise you this, and you know promoters never lie. It's the truth. It might not always be pleasant, but it's the truth.
Uh-huh. How did you feel about Ozzy Osbourne the first time you booked him?
Oh, I felt sorry for him. I booked him in 19... Let's see, it was March of 71. And he was on tour with Mountain. And Black Sabbath was getting so big, and they were selling more than half the tickets, but they were getting like $2,000, $2,500 a night, and Mountain was getting the big money. So I bought the whole band the nice gold watch. And Ozzy still has his today, and this was 1971. I loved Ozzy. I love the whole group, but I've always loved Ozzy. He's a great guy.
I'd like to make
He suffered his toil of what he went through, too.
I'd like to make a statement about people that you've talked about, and the perceptions often are, oh, these people are living a lifestyle of luxury, and they do whatever they want, and they don't really have to work for a living. I would like to say that all the people that I worked with, across paths with, from ZZ Top to Aerosmith to the country people, and Ozzy included, whether you like them or not, it's a hard job.
Yeah, but it's also a blessed job, John. I mean, God bless you to have the ability to step on a stage and make thousands upon thousands of people happy and have a good time. I mean, that's a blessing. I mean, if any of these rock and roll artists used to complain to me, I said, go, you know, take up lathes, go work in a factory, see how you feel about that. It might be hard, but it ain't that hard. Like,
Barry,
you got a hard job. I didn't have a hard job.
Yeah, I don't mean that it was like hard, like being a bricklayer and putting in 14 hours a day. But the idea of doing 100 cities in 110 days is not an easy accomplishment. And it was guys
like
you.
I mean, like I say, if people didn't want to see you, you wouldn't do it.
Yeah, and you did it in order to make money. Doesn't sound like that was the only motivation. I think you like the action.
You must have the wrong number. No,
but
money was the main motivation, and making people happy. I mean, no, the main motivation is really having an effect on your environment, hopefully for the better, you know, and changing people's lives. People come up to me every day still here in Denver, thank you, and it's the memories they have. And that makes it worthwhile. But it was the money was the main motivation of doing the job like anything else. I mean, it was a pleasure. Had I known what I was doing was so cool, I would have really enjoyed it. But there was all this anxiety attached and everything. So we really didn't enjoy it. I mean, and after, you know, afterwards you can say, oh, boy, that was cool. It wasn't so cool when we were doing it.
Was it a lot of stress on you, Barry?
Yeah. Especially the early 70s, John. I mean, the gate crashing and that stuff and the tear gas and all that. That was disgusting.
Is that in the book?
Pardon me?
Some of that's in the book?
Oh, everything's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Everything.
You were known as somebody that was a difficult boss. What do you have to say about that? I mean,
well,
in other words, there was a story that went around, and I'm not offering an opinion here. I'm only relating, like, when Russell Schaaf, John Cougar's manager, you and he had an exchange that might have been considered, from your side, a little over the edge.
Well, I did that. I did tend to, you know, go over the edge. But I had somewhat of a good, I don't say there's ever a really good reason for crucifying people and things like that, but it's a shame because the last chapter of the book was to be working at Feline, but it ran too long and they had to cut that chapter. But, you know, in my final statement, they asked me, what would you like to, you know, say at the end? I said, I wish I would have been nicer. And that was it. But you couldn't always be. And I know the conversation you're talking about, Rush Shaw, I gave him a little less than he deserved. Now, unfortunately, he's not alive to defend himself. But screw him.
Did you think John Cougar, soon to be Mellencamp, was an act that was going to be an impact?
Oh, I knew so. Yeah, but this argument took place before the US Festival in 1983.
Right, right.
So he had already made it. He was very difficult. I really liked him at first. I mean, I thought he was great. But you remember the time in Boulder when he walked off the stage in front of the Who show, and he said he hit his head on something. He was getting booed. I don't know why. I thought he was an excellent act. Very temperamental. I guess he still is. But, you know, you see, all the things in the book are true, but who cares? It happened. The business had to grow up, and I was happy to grow up with it.
Do you feel like this? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, with these acts that you grew up with, you talk about the new acts and the old days and all that. Do you feel like there was a lot of loyalty to the promoter? Because you've already mentioned that. But, you know, if you worked with somebody in the early days, they stuck with you and they really appreciated it because you helped get them out of where they were into the world. Do you see that happening nowadays?
Well, I don't know for sure, but I say no. I mean, I'm not in the business anymore. But I saw the loyalty go away. You couldn't have loyalty because all you have now is national tours. But, I mean, the acts really appreciated you back in those days. And you were it was like your partner, you know what I'm saying? You really grew up with the acts. Now I have no idea. I mean, you have acts charging unconscionable money. And the people paying it, I don't understand where it comes from. You have a terrible economy like we're going through now, and yet they keep paying these ridiculous ticket prices.
As an example, Danny Zaleska told me a couple years ago in Phoenix that there was an act that he booked just because he knew if he didn't take the deal, another promoter would take it and then move into his market a little bit. And the deal was $1 million up front, plus 50% of the, it was 105% of the door.
It had to be Jimmy Buffett.
No, not Buffett.
No?
Well, I was going to avoid names. It was Chesney, Kenny Chesney.
Oh, I would not.
But
$1 million for a country act? That's ridiculous.
Let me turn my phone off.
George,
it was a $500,000 guarantee or something, and 105% of the door. And
105? How are you going to make a living if you're a promoter?
Parking?
That's what's wrong. That also killed the business. When you can make money, and not have to sell tickets, that's wrong. I mean, hot dogs and parking and this and all what they call the insides.
Right. You make money on the back end concessions.
Yeah, I mean, you're supposed to make money by selling tickets to see the talent. And these amphitheaters started all that stuff at 105%. I didn't realize anybody but Buffett did that.
Yeah, but you were running Red Rocks pretty much for years, wouldn't you
say? Yeah, but I didn't own it. I didn't make a penny except from the tickets.
But one of your partners took 35% on merchandise. What that means, maybe it wasn't your partner. The way I understood it, being the lowly musician on the show, was if you guys sell a CD for $20 and you pay $10 to buy your own CD from the company, you need to pay Red Rocks 35% for selling it.
Yeah, but that's the city. That's the city of Denver, John.
Okay, then that's the city of Denver. Good.
We made our money by selling enough tickets to cover the cost of the show.
What people don't realize sometimes is those t-shirts being the phrase meaning all merchandise, often have such a high percentage taken out by the city or the venue that's why you have $45 t-shirts.
Well, 20 to 25 to 30% is taken out by the venue. You try and negotiate it, but I mean, that's business. I mean, they charge rent. They get 10-11% of the gross. I mean, like I say, the only one who doesn't get anything is the promoter. He gets what's left over, and that's why you have all these shows. I read about it in the Wall Street Journal. At amphitheaters back east, they were like a third full, and they would give away tickets because the promoters learned that they could give away a ticket and still make $8, $9, $10 a ticket from giving it away. Yeah, that's not the music business, John.
I don't think I agree with you, Barry. I've agreed with you more than I ever have in my life in this.
Well, it's because you've seen the light.
And you mentioned earlier, like when you brought on Zeppelin or U2, you felt something. You knew something was new. Do you see that with any new acts, even though you're not in the buying to present business now? Do you see the new Rolling Stones coming along? Do you see the next?
I'll cut you off right there. The last great act that I saw, and unfortunately they were manic depressive heroin addicts, was Guns N' Roses.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was 1987, I believe, Appetite for Destruction. I mean, that was a great album. And I'll say the blanket, maybe this will, I don't want to cut you short, but I'll tell you this. Classic rock, the way it's played on the radio today, will be the same in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any new songs going to make it. I don't see Satisfaction or Hey Jude. I don't see those kind of songs. Now, admittedly, I don't listen to like I used to, but come on.
My daughter in 1986, when she turned 16, only wanted one album for her birthday, and that was the Imagine album. And she said,
John Lennon. Yeah.
Yeah. And after she got it, she goes, "Why is it my generation doesn't have music that lasts like this? I mean, I like Poison, but you know, this is better."
Well, that's fine. But I mean, where's your Elton John? Where's your Stones? I mean, look, I teach a class at the University of Colorado, mm-hmm. and it's called The Real History of Rock and Roll. And the kids come in. You should see what's on their iPods. But after 8 weeks, I'm very proud to say a lot of them have classic rock on, because, you know, it's nothing. You got the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, Led Zeppelin. There's nobody like that. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin. Nobody. Nobody.
Since music is often a cultural expression of the times and what went on.
The 60s were great, right?
What's funny about the 60s, when churches were being burned and marches were being done and kids were getting shot on campuses by National Guard, and the president, you know, get shot, and his brother gets shot. People still call those the good old days.
Well, now what do they say? If you remember the 60s, you weren't really there. But I think that the 60s, the music was such an expression of what was going on. I mean, Kent State made me, I don't think you remember this place. It was a little pizza place in Denver called Straight Johnson's. And the Denver Post used to be an afternoon paper. And they threw the papers in, and it said, 4 killed at Kent State. Made me sick. And that's when I ran the ad, and the Post and the News stopped the killing. And I listed how many had been killed in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Kent State. And I put a little asterisk, subject to change. And that got me on Mr. Nixon's enemy list. My life was hell for a couple of years. But, you know, pardon me?
How could it be hell because of that?
Well, how about getting audited, indicted? Whatever they could get me on, they did. And it cost me a lot of money, but after Nixon went down, it was worth it. It was worth it. But the times were, I mean, the 70s, the 60s. But look at the 90s. And that's when I got out. I couldn't take it anymore.
Michael Jackson was the only breath of excitement to many people. Did you ever do
Michael Jackson? Yeah, I just saw that his doctor just was convicted of whatever he was charged with. But came across the crawl on the bottom of the television. Ooh. Not that I'm not paying 100% attention to you, John, but I don't know. They were the best of times. I mean, you'll never have anything like Woodstock. I mean, we're 600,000 people. You put 600,000 adults under those conditions and you would have mayhem. God bless these kids when they were growing up. Everybody was, you know, I don't know. Now I'm going to cry.
You know, I heard an interview with Steve Stills talking about Four Dead in Ohio. The song is about Kent State Massacre, killing four students. I mean, there are some, because of Every Child Left Behind, a lot of kids don't know history of this country, and they don't even know things like that. But he said he feels like if the same thing happened today, that if they did a song, somebody did a song about it, that it wouldn't get played on radio because it wouldn't meet criteria. And what he went through when that came out, was it Ahmet Erdogan that he was on?
Atlantic Records, yeah.
Okay, yeah, Ahmet Erdogan said, because they wanted to put out Four Dead in Ohio song on top of a record that was already almost in the top 20, and they were told, well, that's going to kill your record, and this one won't be a hit. Well, they did it because they had the power to convince the company, and, of course, it went to number one. But the point being that radio is more in a situation today, like when the poor Dixie Chick girl made an offhanded comment in England, they immediately got banned on radio, you know.
They tried to do that back in the 60s, but thank God the underground came to life. You know what I'm saying? The not the corporate AM top 40 stations. And I think it was a great time, but I know how I was affected by Kent State. It was terrible. And you're right. A lot of the kids coming out of school don't know that or anything else, actually. And the music of the time. I love the airplane, though, you know, getting up there, Gracie Slick getting on the stage and saying music should be free, power to the people. But they already had their $25,000, you know. But that's the hypocrisy of our times. But you had to be into it. You could not be oblivious as to what was going on and the terrible injustices. Now, I mean, this country and the kids in it and everything have become so desensitized. I don't know if we're being killed would make any effect.
Well,
you have these demonstrations now, you know, all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Occupy Wall Street, occupy this. I got to tell you something. Nothing like the demonstrations back in the 60s.
Oh, I went down to Occupy Wall Street, and they should have studied demonstrating lessons. Because out of the 500 people there were 450 messages. You know,
all disparate. Everybody said something. It's when I think the Kent State happened on Tuesday or Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And I led a march down 16th Street on that Saturday. And there was a lot of different signs. You know, one was Free Bobby. Everybody had a cause. But the Vietnam War galvanized everybody. That was the one common thing everybody had in common. Stop that war. And mm-hmm. I can't imagine. Look at Afghanistan, Iraq. I don't mean to get political, but ridiculous. I mean, why are we killing all those people? For what? And they say, you know, support our troops. The best way to support our troops, John, is to bring them home. And then you always have this right-wing guy who says, if you bring them home, what are they going to do for jobs? Do what Roosevelt did. I mean, get a real WPA project and put everybody to work. And why should Japan and why should China have a high-speed train across their country and the United States doesn't? We can really build things and rebuild our country, bring our troops home. That's what they want. They don't want to fight. They don't want to get killed. But this could not go on if it was the 60s. Well, I don't know. What do you think, John?
I think that there's a definite – this is getting into a different side in your book. But to go there, I think there's a definite semi-conspiracy that happens with certain agencies to make sure that history does not get taught in the schools. Because if you knew history, you wouldn't repeat it so often. That when people get talked into going, oh, we've got to fight for this, They don't realize that it's the same thing that's been said before, that over there, we've got to go over there. There's always an over there somewhere. And that all the people that vote for war, 99.9% have never been.
No, nor would they be, nor do the children go.
Right. Right.
But it was some time then, back then, and I glad I went through it. I'm very happy I went through it. I was in the Marine Corps before that, and I came here, when I first came here in 67, I was a hawk. But gradually you start seeing what's going on with the lying and the Gulf of Tonkin and this and that, and you say, wait a minute, mm-hmm. It's not true. And then did this country stop that war? And it was a great accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And I managed to leave Chicago before the demonstrations and the riots at the convention. I know a lot of people who got their head busted,
mm-hmm.
and the Chicago 7 and everything, but it turned out all right. John, tell me, how is what's going on now going to turn out all right?
It's
I've never seen such a polarization in this country in my life.
It's interesting that you did something that brought people together, thousands and thousands of people, to music events, and you did it with, now some people that have heard of Barry Fay would think me saying with a lot of heart was a little, they'd say that was a lot for his pocket, but I think you really did have heart in what you presented and the people you brought. You cared about the audience, you cared about what they were going to spend their money on, and you did really great productions to the point where sometimes at Red Rocks in Denver, you were doing, 75 shows a year at Red Rocks alone?
Well, no, actually, the most we ever did in one year was 1985, was 56.
Well,
but we did 92% capacity, and then we followed up with two shows at Mile High with Bruce Springsteen. I mean, it was a great time, and I loved, and I say that in my book, I'm not being hokey here. I love the audiences, and I took care of them. I mean, that show we did, Under a Blood Red Sky at Red Rocks with you two, magic is a much overused word, but it was magic. I couldn't move. I had Neil Diamond downtown that night. I was supposed to go. I could not leave Red Rocks. It was one of the great shows.
Well, do you feel like there's promoters with your... Now, I think that Danny Zalesko has that kind of feeling about shows. Danny invited me to Phoenix a couple years ago because he says, "Hi, you're a Bill Maher fan. I've got him at Celebrity Theater," which is a 2,500-seat theater in the round. "Why don't you come into town and we'll have dinner and I'll meet you there." He comes in the back door of the Celebrity Theater. Bill Maher's been on stage for 5 minutes. He goes, "Look at this, look at this, look at this. I got, what he was excited about is he had Bob Skaggs across town and he had a set list from the show they were doing right then. He sounded like he was 15 years old. And he
I'm surprised. I didn't even know he was still promoting. Of course, he started later than we did, but...
He started later, and he got bought out, Live Nation.
Everybody buys out. That's another. They buy out everybody, and they don't do their own booking.
He's still doing it. He still does a couple hundred shows a year.
That's good. I mean, we didn't particularly get along because we were competitors.
Right, but my point was...
I was in Phoenix before he was, and I resented him coming in.
But my point, Barry, was I saw these people from a different perspective than you did. They had something I didn't have, a check. They had something that we didn't have as a group and none of the agents had, a venue. They had foresight to read the market and go, "This can work here. I'll write them a check. They'll come. I'll do the show." So I saw these various promoters around the country, and there were very few that were like you or Danny or Chuck Morris or... Now, whether there's things that you get along or don't get along with some of them, I will say from my perspective, they were always good to work for, like you were, Barry.
Well, come on, John. Don't make me feel that good. Come on.
Well, look, I'm not
there's five promoters here now in Denver who work for Live Nation or AEG, and they all worked for me. That's a good feeling. I have some great alumni across the country. Bill Silva in Los Angeles, people like that. They were raised right to care about the audience.
Did you ever work with Larry Magid in Philadelphia?
No.
Now, Larry Magid sold to Live Nation, and I heard from one of his partners, this is the part of the business I don't think you like, that here's a story that you might be familiar with in other situations, that the partner had a no-compete clause for a couple years, and 2 years went by, and he wanted to book a certain group in Allentown. That group was out on a Live Nation tour doing 26 shows. He made the offer, and he was told that they were turning it down because if they took that offer, Live Nation would cancel the other 25 shows.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what I'm saying. One of the great guys and great promoters ever was Jack Boyle, right, in Florida.
Right.
And he was brought out.
D.C.
And the same thing happens, and they're so unhappy. But you see, let me give you, what's the best example? I'm trying to think. All right, you too. I love you too. And what in the book you'll see things that they did for me that beyond what any group would do for anybody. But they came to Denver, and they invited me backstage. We had a nice dinner and took pictures, and I went to sat out front, and after the third song, Bono said, hey, where are we tonight? And, of course, the crowd yelled Denver. He said, well, if we're in Denver, we got to talk about Barry and Red Rocks. And then they dedicated a song to me. Now, the song they dedicated was, I think, Running to Stand Still, which is about a heroin addict. So I don't know. I don't get the relationship, but that doesn't matter. But I couldn't have got them to play for me. And I would say at the time they didn't love anybody more than me.
Oh,
but they had a contract with Live Nation.
Oh.
And that's the way it is. And if they give me Denver, they're going to have to give somebody else somebody, and it'll break it. So they don't do that. And it doesn't matter what relationship you have. That's what I'm saying. It's changed, John.
I understand.
It's changed.
So my point is, Barry Fay, I believe, is proud to be an American, would you say?
Proud to be an American? What am I, you talking to Lee Greenwood here or what?
No, I don't mind. I mean, I don't mind saying that in spite of everything that's wrong. There's more things right. There have been. And, yes, I'm not talking about current times. I'm talking about when you were doing that.
I was the quintessential ugly American. I used to travel abroad, and I used to go to De Gaulle Airport, and a bell would go off. They'd say, oh, boy, he's back. We can screw with him again, you know. But things have changed a lot. They really have. And Bill Maher is a great example.
Uh-huh.
The things he says, he means. He's a loyal American, but you know what he says, and he means it.
Well, what I say is, I feel like I am too. And how come restraint of trade is not something that can be applied to the concert business in a situation like you just quoted, or like I talked about Bill Maher? And, you know, you dominated some markets, but did you ever keep anybody from moving into them?
You bet.
You did. And that was
fair. And I did anything I could to do it, too. As long as it was legal. I mean, I would call up a manager and say, listen, he says, I deserve more than this. He says, because my band is number six in your market. I said, not after I make a phone call, they won't be. I did all that stuff. I mean, you defended your territory. I mean, that's the way it is. But, I mean, it wasn't restraint of trade because I didn't own anything. In other words, I couldn't stop anybody from playing Red Rocks or McNichols or the Coliseum or any other place. That was a city facility. But the acts and the agents and the managers had a loyalty, John.
Yeah.
They don't have that anymore.
You think it's going to affect things in general?
I think it's already affected. I think music does not have the place in our society that it once did. I mean, in this town, in this area, music was a religion. Now it's just another form of entertainment. I mean, it used to be, oh, my God, such a good time.
Why do you want people to read this book?
Well,
it's not just the money.
Believe me.
Yeah, I was going to say, you already established it, that you did a thing for the money, but I think you also did it because you loved it. And now you have
this
message.
Is something that I have years since I retired. People have told, when are you going to write the book? When you got such great stories, when are you going to write the book? And but there's a certain barrier, John, that you have to cross to think that you have a book that you're going to write that someone's going to read. That takes a big step to do it. And I retired in 97, and here it is 14 years later, and I'm finally writing the book. And I think, and everybody who's read it, I mean, you know, obviously the co-writer, the man who took down the transcription, his wife, the publisher, they love it. They say it's a good read. But they have a vested interest. They can't be, you know, impartial. But, I mean, the stories are good, and they're basically they're true. And no matter what's said, it doesn't really matter. Because if you call somebody a name, it doesn't matter. They had their part in this business, which was a great business. And it's gone.
It's gone. You're really saying you think it's gone. And I'm still out there on the road doing 110 cities a year. Maybe I should rethink what I'm doing.
Yeah, but let me ask you a question. Who do you play for?
The audience. I always tell people I work for them.
And don't you play for the same promoters you always played for?
There's some new ones because some of the old, you know, Don Fox is gone, and, you know, and John Stoll in Florida played with him. But, you know, the Phantasma went away, or he did.
I see.
Jack Boyle changed. But there is some fealty, some loyalty with certain people like Zimmerman at Wolf Trap and Graham Slayton up in, at the Wheeler Opera House. And, you know, I'm not doing stadiums, but Wolf Trap's a nice-sized place. There's some... I'd say that loyalty is more on the buyer side now than the promoter side.
Well, like I say, it was the music business. Now it's the business of music. I'm not trying to just be pander, but I know you always did it in a certain way, but I'm sure you're still doing it in a certain way. And you allow everybody to make a living, and that's that. To charge 105% of the gross because they're making money on popcorn? Come on.
No, I don't. I didn't condone that. I would go along with that myself. Let me say right now that this is the Americana Music Show. This is John McEwen talking with Barry Fay, one of the premier concert promoters that helped create the whole rock and roll concert scene, along with Bill Graham and various promoters around the country. But Barry is one of the most noted that built friendships with the groups that he worked with that allowed him to continue a career for many, many years, averaging 300 to 350 shows a year with major acts and everybody in between. Barry, why did it stop for you?
Well, I didn't like it anymore. I mean, I used to love to go to the office and just start throwing things and start shouting and, you know, have a lot of fun. It was no fun anymore. And I actually had a buyout clause with Universal. And I wasn't going to come up with $3 million. Mm-mm. I wasn't. I didn't like the music. I didn't like the people. And don't forget, SFX had started then, and that was the predecessor of what was first Clear Channel, now Live Nation. And that wasn't for me. I had my time. I had 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, 30 years in this business is like, oh, my God, I don't know what any kind of regular job would be. But it just was not fun, and I'll tell you, it was getting away from me. The music, thank God for Chuck Morris and people like that, and Pam Moore, because I didn't understand it anymore.
Well,
I mean, I don't think you have a different opinion because you're involved in this on a daily basis. I tell you, I don't hear it. On no new group do I hear it. I don't care.
I'm in a different situation. I'm a folky guy that's in a country hippie rock band that got lucky, and we have a name that is good, but I also spend half my time doing solo performances talking about the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and playing music is from 1880 through now. And I love performing. If I have 500 people a night, I'm totally happy. You know,
You said it right. We all got lucky. We were lucky to be in this business at a time when it mattered. And it was a great business, and the music was great. And it just isn't anymore, John. And I'm not saying like our fathers used to say, I don't like what you listen to. It genuinely isn't good anymore.
You mean the business or the music or both?
The music. And the business sucks. But the music, I won't comment on hip-hop and this techno stuff, I just don't understand it. But I'm talking about rock and roll music is not the same.
The new rock and roll music.
No.
What was the last show you did? Do you remember?
Last show I did.
When you walked away, when you walked away and walked out of that room, what was that like?
Oh, I was happy. It was like my first divorce. I really was very, very happy, and I felt free, and I had no misgivings whatsoever.
It was Bruce Springsteen?
Bruce Springsteen, yeah.
Where and when?
Mile High Stadium.
Sold out, I imagine.
Yeah, sure. I don't think he ever had a ticket to go unsold in this market since the first time. You know, he wouldn't play outside. Frank Barcelona and I tried to get him to play Red Rocks a few times. And he said, I don't play outside. And I said, Frank, tell him it's indoors without a roof. And he finally played it and said it was the best place he ever played in his life. See, we're blessed here because I've done almost 1,000 shows at Red Rocks.
Wow.
No one's come close to that. But it's see, every other place is made by man. Red Rocks is made by God.
You respected that.
Oh, I mean, I arrived there the first time. My first show there was September 1st, 1968, and was Jimi Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix, Vanilla Fudge, The Soft Machine, and Heir Apparent. And we both arrived at the same time, and it was awe-inspiring. It was just, you looked up, and it was, well, you know what it's like. It's
yeah. Just amazing. Did it sell out?
Are you kidding?
No, because...
Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah, but...
Vanilla Fudge?
He didn't have airplay. You're a new promoter. It's just,
I don't care. It's $5. You know what I did? Because Kim wouldn't play the song. I did a commercial, and I just played 55 seconds of You Keep Me Hanging On by Vanilla Fudge. People were calling up and requesting the commercial. No, it sold out in a week. And the tickets were $5.
How much did Hendrix get that night? He must have gotten...
10,000.
Yeah, I was going to say about 10, yeah. Which was a hell of a lot then. A heck of a lot then. And,
yeah.
What was the highest payout you did in this world of high-level rock and roll? I don't need to know the group. I'm just curious about the amount.
About $1,000,001.
Really?
But it wasn't guaranteed.
No, I mean final after the show's over, settling up.
Yeah, they earned it. They earned it because the people came.
Right. I agree that is the way it happened. That must have been fun for you, having those victories.
Yeah, it was. Hey, it was 4.5 years before I ever had a losing concert.
And what happened there?
I lost with Stephen Stills in Kansas City, July 14th, 1971. I forgot to figure the sales tax right, and we lost about $2,600.
Do you remember this?
Try and do that now.
What, lose $2,600?
No, I mean, they go 4.5 years without a loser.
And I don't think it's possible. I remember one show that you booked with great energy and zeal was at the Superdome with Willie Nelson,
Jimmy Buffett,
Admitting Witty Dirt Band, Oak Ridge Boys.
Yep.
That lost.
I learned. And then you don't ever try and have something for free. I mean, you don't charge people when the biggest game in town is for free. We were there during Mardi Gras. And
so
people would say.
Would you say that cut out? We were there during. Restate that.
Mardi Gras. So you had the biggest free show in the world down the street. And we're asking people to come to Superdome and pay. Not very good idea, Barry. Not very good.
I think there was like 8,000 people in the Superdome, which is kind of like having one person in your house.
Well, it was set up for 30.
Oh. It was a difficult day for you, I bet.
Yeah, well, you got to take the good ones with the bad ones.
Well, Barry, I was glad to be there.
I'm glad you were happy.
Well, I got the guarantee, right?
Right.
And you got the bite. You have the fame of the show. We've been talking with Barry Fay, one of the main concert promoters, presenters, a man who created a definite social impact with music as well as a concert event, the whole thing, helped create the rock and roll concert scene. Barry has a new book out. book, and you're calling it?
Backstage Past.
Past, P-A-S-T?
Yes.
And your website is, by the way,
MaryFaye.com.
Yeah,
and you can get it on all this new stuff. You get it on Amazon.com and, I forgot the name of the thing with Barnes & Noble has Zook or something like that.
Kindle
is the other one, and but you can buy it at MaryFaye.com, and I'm sure soon in your, your local bookstore?
We hope, and Faye is spelled...
You see, when I was growing up, in the business, there was two kind of people. Mm-hmm. People who bought tickets and those who didn't buy tickets. And now there's people who buy books and people who don't buy books.
Well, I hope we've attracted some that do buy books, because this is a definite cool read. If you want to know what happened at some of these shows and what went on behind them. And Fey is spelled F-E-Y, by the way. Barry,
yes.
B-A-R-R-Y, F-E-Y. And anything you'd like to add, Barry?
It's been an honor talking to you, and usually I didn't enjoy it so much, but this I enjoyed.
Oh, you're sweet.
That's me. That's my middle name is Sweet.
Yeah, I bet. Is there anything?
No, but I think you'll enjoy the book, John, because, of course, you were a part of it, but there's a lot of things in there, and being told for the first time, but, everybody will like it.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. And when people are listening to this interview on syndicatednews.net, you'll also be able to scroll down and buy it as Barry's talking about what it's about. So you can check that out, too, if you have trouble finding it. Barry, is there anything you'd like to add about anything?
No, I think you said it the best. We were all very, very lucky to be in a beautiful business at a beautiful time.
I thought you said that.
I said that?
I'll attribute it to you.
Okay.
By the way, we are hoping that this will be carried in by it on the China. This sounds funny, Barry, but this site is also carried in China in some restricted aspect. But if you go to syndicatednews.net for Malaysia and all of Asia, it's available. And you can see the Chinese character website that will get you closer to buying it.
That's amazing. I had a couple of stories I could have told about China. Like, I was supposed to be their first Western promoter to do shows there.
Mm-hmm.
We had a deal, and then we bombed their embassy in Kosovo by mistake. But so that ended that deal.
Yeah, they get picky about things like that.
Yeah. I love the place. I've visited there many times. I love it.
You have? But
yeah. It's a great place to visit.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for visiting, Barry Faye, and I recommend that if people want to understand or know about anything about what went on behind the scenes on the other side of the ticket box, well, Barry Faye is the guy that has the stories. The backstage.
And I pledge to do it like I did before, John.
Pardon?
They might not like it, but it's true. Best you can do.
Well, I'm looking forward to visiting China someday myself, and there's a chance that the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, which was the first American group to go to, well, still is the first American group to play in Russia.
Russia? I remember you went to Russia, yeah.
We went in 1977, did 28 shows.
Wow.
And 28 sold-out shows that are still being talked about today. And Barry?
And people didn't understand a word you said. That was great.
No, actually, it was amazing. There was a man that I met there named Pete Anderson that had been not only arrested and put in jail, but beat up many, many times because he was playing American rockabilly music and it was illegal. And I met him in 77 after he quit playing, but things changed to the point where Pete Anderson's going to join the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band in Kansas, and we're shooting a film called Rockin' the Kremlin. It's already shot. It's about American music, which you helped promote, about how American music brought down the Iron Curtain and spread the cultural viewpoint.
Wow, I'm just in awe. That's great. Well, best man. God bless you, Johnny.
We had a small part of that, Barry, but you had a part in us being successful, so I thank you for that.
And, boy, are you welcome.
And, anyway... We're hoping to, maybe we'll have dinner in China sometime. I hope that happens. Yeah.
This is Barry Fay on syndicatednews.net.
Thank you. Nice having you.
Thanks, man.
See you down the road.